It's a rivalry for the ages. Max Verstappen ends up in the wall, but Lewis Hamilton is back in the title hunt in an unforgettable British Grand Prix. This is the F1 Strategy Report. My name's Michael Laminato, and welcome to Round 10, the British Grand Prix, for Heeltread.com, socks inspired by iconic cars. Use the code word STRATEGY for 10% off. Lewis Hamilton's British Grand Prix weekend was a roller coaster. He was fastest in qualifying on Friday in an emphatic display for the home fans, but Max Verstappen deprived him of pole at the start of the all-new sprint qualifying session on Saturday. Hamilton knew he had to start closing the points gap, and Sunday he was determined to get ahead on the first lap to control the race. But no one could have imagined what happened next. After 8 corners of close battling, the two collided at the superfast Copse Corner. Verstappen was off in a 51G impact. Hamilton continued with a penalty, but still won the race. It was the biggest talking point in a weekend of intrigue and is sure to dominate the championship narrative from now until December. In what is understandably a longer podcast than usual, to analyse the weekend from all the angles, who better to speak to than ESPN F1 editor Lawrence Edmondson? Lawrence, how are you doing?
Very good, Michael. How are you?
Oh, I'm still buzzing, I think. It was a very late race where I was, but I can tell you that after everything that happened, I'm still not 100% sure what to make of everything we saw.
No, there was an awful lot to dissect there, and there's the obvious stuff, but then it's also the ramifications and the split opinions. You know, I mean, I made my mind up pretty quickly on the incident that I'm sure we'll talk about, and I can tell you what I thought in a second. But it was interesting going and talking to other people, and everybody had a slightly different opinion, and then there were some very, very extreme opinions from the people you would expect to have extreme opinions on something like that. So the man who ended up in hospital had some pretty extreme opinions about it. Yeah. Fair enough. The man whose car was completely destroyed within a budget cap and his driver ended up in hospital, Mr. Christian Horner, had some extremely strong opinions on it. So yeah, it was interesting. And I think you know, I'm so glad Max is okay, first of all, because when I saw that car go in, you know, there's a huge eruption from the crowd. I think initially of, oh my God. And then there was an element of, oh, isn't this great? Because it's a home crowd supporting Lewis Hamilton. And then there was, I think, genuine concern. And, you know, I mean, my initial feeling, having covered this sport for a long time, and you know, I've seen some nasty stuff happen as well, was I really hope he's fine. And to see him get out the car, albeit winded, clearly winded, so that gives you an idea of quite how heavy that impact was a good thing to see. But once we'd seen that, it was like, wow, this is really kind of what the championship needed, because there was this concern that Max Verstappen was going to run away with it. He had that 32-point lead, I think, 33-point lead after the sprint, and and then this has really turned it all around and added a whole load of extra spice to it as we head to Hungary. But where do we start, Michael? What did you think?
Well, look, let's start with the crash, because it seems silly not to go straight to the headline event between, of course, the title contenders, as you say, Verstappen starting on the real pole of the weekend amongst several debatable pole positions, I suppose. Lewis Hamilton trying to get past him. Their race lasted all of 9 laps, effectively. Hamilton's, of course, continued. But I mean, as you said, it's extremely divisive. There was no, and there's still not really any, you know, in the aftermath with everyone cooled down, a settling on any consensus. You mentioned Christian Horner had some more extreme opinions about it, suggested at one point that Lewis Hamilton committed a professional foul, which suggests intent. Helmut Marko said shortly before he left the race, before it had finished, it's not like he had 3 other cars in it, that Lewis Hamilton should be suspended for at least a race. But then, of course, you know, Lewis Hamilton Mercedes thought very much the opposite of that. I want to start, what did you see having led to this? How did you see it unfold? Do you think the penalty was fair? I'm going to ask you all the obvious questions, because there is no easy answer.
No, there isn't. My opinion is that it was a racing incident. And I'll tell you why. And it's basically because going towards that corner, Lewis was alongside. He was on the tighter line. He was on the inside line. He then lifted off. But I feel like because he got himself into position where he was alongside, it was on both drivers to make sure there wasn't a collision. And admittedly, I agree to some extent with what the steward said, that Lewis did not make the apex of the corner. Therefore, he was in some way to blame. But equally, Max didn't lift at all. So you saw Lewis lift first, which was why his nose was then behind Max, going kind of at the turning point. And Max didn't lift at all, and he just went fully in. So we saw later, okay, different scenario, different cars, slightly different lines into the corner. But we saw a similar thing with Charles Leclerc, and obviously Charles had that twitch of the rear and went wide, but the two of them managed to negotiate the corner without colliding. So I feel like it was possible. So I felt, you know, when we're looking at, was it wholly or predominantly to blame on one driver, which is the essentially what the stewards are looking for to give out a penalty, I felt it wasn't wholly or predominantly. I felt it was a racing incident. And so, I feel like those things happen in Formula One. It's part of why we tune in, let's be honest, for that kind of drama, you know, and penalising it, I felt was a bit rich. But then I've talked to so many people who I respect their opinion, and they've said that they felt that the stewards got it spot on, and I can see the argument of the stewards as well, because Lewis wasn't properly tucked into that apex when he went through. It was interesting to hear kind of how it came about, because a similar scenario played out on the first lap of the sprint race, and I think Lewis found himself on the outside because Max blocked the inside, and then he backed off and then Max ran away with it. And one of the reasons that this happened twice was that the way that Honda had set up their power unit was to kind of basically harvest a little bit into turn nine, and or certainly not deploy into turn nine. And the reason for that was that they were worried about putting too much strain on the tyres, or at least that's a theory, that they were worried about putting too much strain on the tyres through there. So, you know, if you knock a little bit off into turn nine, it's not a disaster. Okay, you're going to cost a tiny bit of, you know, apex speed, but it's such a fast corner anyway that you're not going to spend much time in it. You're not going to lose much time. But Mercedes has spotted this, certainly in the sprint race. So I think Lewis already had it as one of the parts of the track where he knew he would have this slight advantage coming from his Mercedes power unit deploying its energy while the Honda one might not be. And so I think that's kind of one of the reasons it came about, which is, you know, it's even more fascinating in that I think Lewis probably thought, here is a chance. And he probably also thought, if I don't do it now, once we get into Maggots, Beckett's Chapel, it's kind of, it really is one follow the other. You know, you very rarely get overtaking manoeuvres there. And so that was his chance and he went for it. And that's where I stand on it. But I, like I said, I can understand, given also the penalties that were given out in Austria, many of which I didn't agree with, the stewards, you know, if they were looking to issue a penalty, I can kind of understand how they came to the conclusion they did, even if I don't agree with it.
It does. It's interesting, isn't it? Because it's a shame in some respects that I agree almost 100% with what you said, and I don't have a lot to add in that regard. But I do think it's interesting that while, you know, in my opinion also it was a racing incident, I can understand why you would penalise Hamilton, but I couldn't imagine you penalising Verstappen, which I think probably speaks a little bit to where the balance probably lies. But on the other hand, you mentioned there, you know, Max didn't back out, but at one point it became clear that he had seen Lewis in his mirrors because he opened up the steering slightly but then recommitted to the corner, giving him only fractionally more room than he otherwise would have had on the apex. So I think it's fair to say that there is blame to go around. And then you could also say that 10 seconds is obviously the second most lenient racing penalty you can get. So was it as great a penalty as perhaps it's been made out for those who think that he shouldn't have got a penalty? It's sort of interesting. And there's also this idea that it feels like almost every incident cops a penalty at this point. And I wonder if you touched on it there, there's this precedent aspect, particularly having come from Austria a couple of weeks ago where we saw a good few handed out, whether or not it just feels like incidents must be penalised now, particularly when we have what we all want, apparently, which is gravel over the side of the track that does make these kind of incidents particularly costly.
Yeah, it does seem like that. And it's an interesting one because, obviously, Max crashing out of the race, scoring 0 points and going to hospital, you know, you see all of that and you think, well, you know, how can Lewis go unpenalised in that, you know, when he goes on and wins the race? But we talked to Michael Massey afterwards in the paddock, and you know, he said it's still the case that that the consequences of the incident should not impact on the penalty. So let's say Max had, you know, they'd made contacts, Max had a little wiggle, gone off into the runoff area, somehow collected it all, and rejoined in third or fourth. In theory, Lewis would still have had a 10-second penalty, according to what Michael Massey said afterwards. Now, that wouldn't seem right to me because, it really would seem like a racing incident. And so, yeah, that's where I struggle with it, is that we are in this position now where if one driver gets heavily disadvantaged, and to go back a race to Perez and Norris, and obviously Perez was disadvantaged for something which, you know, Lando did something which I think Lando was entirely entitled to do, then it seems like when that one driver gets disadvantaged, then there has to be a penalty on the other. And I think that's a very dangerous situation to get into. And, I think we are going to have a lot of races decided by penalties, a lot of positions decided by penalties this year because the precedent that's been set and the way the stewarding is going. But it's an incredibly tricky one. You know, it's an incredibly tricky one. And also when you've got a steward's room with Toto Wolff knocking on the door outside. And then, we heard on the radio, didn't we, that Toto had sent Michael Massey an email. And I think the contents were basically, look, here's the diagram of what the FIA say you're allowed to do. And Lewis was within that. And then Michael said, well, I can't check my emails. Go and tell it to the stewards. And so Toto did. And then when Christian Horner got wind that Toto had gone to the stewards, he also ran up to the stewards. And so they were both there fighting out their case to the stewards, which, you know, it reminds me of a situation in football where you've got, you know, captains kind of running up to the referee and trying to impose their opinion on a penalty decision or something like that. And so that's an interesting one. But actually, it turns out the FIA are completely fine with that. I asked Michael about that afterwards. I said, you know, is that a situation you want when you've got team principals going up and lobbying stewards? And he said, well, you know, if it was a post-race penalty or post-race investigation, we'd welcome the teams up to the stewards' room to put forward their opinions. So they do. So they obviously believe that the stewards are capable of fending off, I'm sure, the very convincing arguments of Mr. Wolff and Mr. Horner and making their own decisions. So that's good. But it was so charged, wasn't it? And because it was such a big accident, because it was so dangerous, and because it's kind of the nature of Formula One, it was so emotionally charged afterwards. And I think probably whatever either of us say here, there'll be several listeners that completely disagree with us. But I guess that's also what makes the sport so brilliant, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I do like the idea. I mean, you can tell Toto Wolff is an executive level operator if he can type up an email that quickly and reference the FIA regulations, which are pretty dense. To find the page he needed is impressive. So, you know, hats off to him for that. I hope that scored him at least a couple of points. But to take it back to the context of this crash, because there is and you touched on a degree of it earlier, an element of the broader strategy battle that people were expecting going into this race, which was that these cars were relatively closely contested. But Hamilton really felt that to get this one over Max, having seen what happened in the sprint race, getting the lead of the first corner or the first turn, getting the lead of the first lap, I should say, was crucial to his race. That played part of what Christian Horner called desperate, even though I think desperate in his sense was probably a little bit stronger than the sense that I'm trying to use it in. How much of this crash, and not just this crash, but let's talk about this weekend overall here, was about Mercedes and Lewis really trying to re-establish this championship? Because you touched on earlier, there was this feeling before this weekend that there was a real risk Max was going to run away with this one. How much of this crash can we say is down to this being a bit of a crunch weekend for the championship? Funny though it is to say, with up to 13 more rounds to go.
Yeah, I think there is an element of that. I think there's also been an element of inevitability throughout this season that Lewis and Max are going to come together. And I suppose the more that it became one-sided, perhaps the less likely that was to happen. So this was the moment where Lewis had to make a difference. And he certainly did that. arguably it wasn't making a difference fairly, but you know, these are arguments that people will have. But I think all of that did contribute. I think it did. And you know, Mercedes knew that they had a car that at this circuit was certainly closer to Red Bull, but they also knew that in a standard straightforward race without, you know, a safety car or without a long stoppage or anything, then probably it was going to be a one stopper, and probably the car that leads the race was going to maintain that throughout, because you know they were going to have to monitor some blistering, and they were going to probably try and push each other into a mistake and all this kind of stuff, or push each other into struggling with the tires. But I think they'd already seen in the sprint race how kind of easy Max could have it if he was out in the lead, and that was what the game plan was going into the first lap. I'm sure, you know, I'm sure they talked about it. You know, Lewis, you've got to find a way past Max. But you know, as much as Lewis gave it, you know, so did Max. You know, Max defended hard throughout that lap, even before the, you know, the incident. And I thought it was fantastic to watch, you know, real kind of edge of the seat stuff, you know, no one giving an inch. That's exactly what we want to see in Formula One. So yeah, it all came together. And I think there probably was an element of inevitability that we ended up here. And, you know, if you look at Lewis in Imola, well, Lewis was the one that backed down there and, you know, gave Max perhaps, an extra inch that avoided a collision that took out one of the cars there. And then this time he just wasn't doing it. Because, as you say, you know, if he'd done it now, that could well have been, you know, a turning point in the title that had gone Max's way. I still feel like Max is in a stronger position for the rest of the year. I still feel like the Red Bull's going to be the faster car at the balance of the circuits. But yeah, Lewis and Mercedes needed a result here, and they got it.
Well, he certainly got it, and how. Yeah. But let's talk about the weekend a little bit overall leading up to that point more generally. Mercedes brought updates to this round. That was part of the importance of this weekend, I suppose, their last update package for the season. Although they said only a couple of weeks ago there were no updates to come, but this is the last one. So the proving of those updates are important this weekend. But in the context of this being a bit of an experimental weekend, this to accommodate the sprint qualifying, don't call it a race on Saturday afternoon, sprint qualifying, the sprint, as has become known. But the knock-on of that, of course, is that we had a dramatic reduction in practice time, effectively a two-thirds reduction. We did have two practice sessions, but one of them, as we'll touch on in a second, was pretty much useless. How much pressure does that put on teams when they've got one session? We see this occasionally when we get washouts or things like that, that we do tend to get unusual results sometimes, or teams that feel like they really didn't hit the maximum of their car. The difference this weekend being they knew what they were getting into, but then you have the likes of Mercedes bringing updates. We also had practice at an unusual time on Friday too, whereas we're used to having very regular timing. What was the effect of this part of this schedule shakeup on what we eventually got in the race?
What we got in the race, well, I think it was an element of that single practice session giving teams fewer answers before they were locked into their setup. So usually, on a normal race weekend, teams have the 3 1-hour sessions to refine setups before the park for May conditions come in ahead of qualifying, or basically when they leave the garage in qualifying, and then they're stuck with whatever the car setup is for the race. Now, of course, in the new format, those park for May regulations come in when the car leaves the garage in qualifying on a Friday evening, which means they've just had the one single hour to refine setups. And it was interesting to hear that Lewis Hamilton had been down the road at Brackley that morning, because, as you say, it was all pushed into the afternoon and evening, I think, to allow people to finish work and watch it, or perhaps even finish work, turn up at the track, and also for the American audience, I guess, as well. You know, it doesn't harm. Not so good for the Australian audience, sorry Michael, but you know, you can't please everyone, can you? So the impact of all that was, yeah, that Lewis on a Friday morning with nothing to do, I mean, there really was not much going on around in the paddock. You know, I got in relatively early to avoid the traffic, and it was pretty quiet, and no one really knew what to do with themselves. But Lewis took himself along to Brackley, got himself in the simulator, ran through some setup ideas. That simulator seems to be becoming an increasingly valuable tool for not just Mercedes, but Lewis himself to get dialed in for races. We heard that he was there between the two Austrias. He was there between France and Austria, doing extra time in it. And, you know, this is a guy who you would usually have to wave his contract at him to get him to go into the simulator. He's not a fan of it, and yet he was there going in. So the fact he was able to do that was interesting, because, you know, they obviously ran through some setup ideas there. The ones that definitely weren't going to work, they can rule out for that hour of practice, and then everybody else is locking it in. So, but, you know, it's one of those things. If you get it wrong early on, you're going to struggle the rest of the weekend. But there were some examples that went the other way, I guess. You know, Lance Stroll really wasn't happy. Fairly random example, but a good one to give. He really wasn't happy after that first practice session, but went on to score points in the race. So, you know, it could work out the other way. You know, it wasn't a complete disaster if you finished that session unhappy, but it was extra pressure on all the teams, all the drivers, just to get it nailed down in that single hour, which I think is a good thing for Formula One. Okay, it's not so good when the team that's got everything dialed in and sorted does it immediately, and, you know, runs away with it. But I think in the instances where we've seen either rain affect it, or we've seen the shorter format in Imola last year, it's always actually created some bigger question marks going into the race. So I'm all for it. And actually, I think that was one of the real successes of this new format.
Something we didn't get to see play out in, let's say, to its fullest extent, at least with Max Verstappen's car, was that Red Bull felt it had left too much downforce on the car after first practice. It looked really dominant in first practice. Mercedes was focusing more on long-run performance, but also this lower downforce package they were using that left them quicker on the straights. On the evidence of the sprint race, I suppose, wasn't quite enough to make a difference, but how that would play out over the course of a full Grand Prix, we'll never know exactly. But it also meant something they didn't predict, or something that they didn't account for given the race, was at a more regular time, a warmer time, was that it was 6 p.m. local, wasn't it, that qualifying was taking place, so getting into the evening, and the cooling track temperatures left Max Verstappen with a bit too much understeer. The front tyres weren't quite up to temperature for his Q3 lap. Didn't get not pole. The fastest lap of qualifying, did not get that. Lewis Hamilton got it, though, thanks a little bit to Valtteri Bottas in not his first instance of teamwork this weekend. I felt like this was a weekend, and we'll talk about this over the course of the rest of this podcast as well, where the teammates did have a key role to play in, well, in Red Bull's case, salvaging something from this weekend. And in Mercedes' case, really winning Lewis Hamilton the Grand Prix.
Yeah, that's right. That's an interesting dynamic, isn't it? And it's clearly already shifted that way. I guess that was, you know, that's probably been the case for a little while. But also interesting when you got two drivers out of contract for the following year. And, yeah. You know, Valtteri, I mean, you know, if Valtteri really felt that he didn't have a contract for next year, then maybe he wouldn't be so compliant. So, yeah, it's interesting that there's some little dynamics going on there. But, yeah, you're right. It did have a big impact on both the race and the starting tire for Bottas in the sprint as well. So it's an interesting factor that the teams can play. But it was also another one of those weekends where Hamilton and Verstappen were in a league of their own, you know, and Valtteri was 2 tenths off, I think, in Friday qualifying from Lewis. But, you know, Lewis clearly had the potential for a quicker lap in that car, obviously made that mistake right at the end of his second attempt in Q3. So, it was one of those weekends where really it seemed whatever Bottas did, he wasn't on Lewis's level. And, you know, I think that's increasingly been the case this year because Hamilton and Verstappen are pushing each other so hard. And when you are that bit slower, it's quite hard to argue, you know, with the team over kind of doing stuff for the benefit of the team overall and the lead driver, because, you know, if you're not there on pace, then it's hard to, you know, hard to put forward yourself in an argument to have the better strategy or whatever.
Looking at Saturday now, just quickly before we look at some of the other aspects that weren't the crash from the Sunday Grand Prix, we've of course had the first practice of Saturday, but that was under Parc Fermé conditions, as we've mentioned, and that was before the sprint qualifying, the 30-minute not race, don't call it a race again, apparently, where we had, of course, no pit stops, free tyre choice. We saw a couple of drivers try out the softs, most opted for the mediums. We got a little bit of action, but of course that settled down, as I guess it tends to in any stint in Formula One when everyone's on essentially the same strategy towards the end of it. What did we learn from sprint in terms of its effect on the race? One of the aspects of it, of course, a little bit external from the event itself, is that free tyre choice carried through into Sunday's race, which is obviously a little bit of a change. Do you think, on the basis, of course, of only one example, and we've got a couple more left this season, that it is increasingly going to be viewed as the first 100 kilometres of a 400-kilometre race? Or is there the possibility that this does become more of a standalone with more opportunities to run it?
It's an interesting one because when I first looked at the regulations, that stood out to me that it's essentially like putting out a red flag after 100 kilometers and then everyone's sleeping on what to do next. And you know, there's it's kind of appealing in some ways. Obviously, you get the two race starts, and we know from Sunday that a race start is when it can all happen. You know, the first lap is often very, very exciting in Formula One and often can have some very, very big consequences. So, you know, we get that, which is pretty exciting. It does give the teams a fairly good window into what's going to happen in the race itself. And I don't think, because of the way that the the Sunday race played out, I don't think that was a negative thing in the end this weekend, but I think in future races perhaps it will be. You know, we talk about that single practice session on a Friday morning before Parc for May, but then if you're then gathering data in a real life race experience anyway, you know, does that take away a little bit from Sunday's race? I think like we probably need a few more examples. We'll get two more this year, so hopefully that will give us some more answers as to what it's actually going to do. But that would be my main concern, is that they get too good an understanding too early on as to what's going to happen in the race proper. But I think, you know, for the benefit of those two starts, you know, Alonso provided the entertainment really in the sprint by going on an alternative strategy, bolting on the softs. It was interesting, could you say free tyre choice? And of course it was, but really for the top 10 it kind of wasn't, because they'd used all their soft tyres in qualifying. So you could, of course you could start on a set of softs with three laps on them already, but you know, that often takes away the initial advantage you have from those soft tyres. Of course we saw Valtteri do that, and he didn't really make any difference to his race. It just made it a bit harder later on. But for someone like Alonso starting, I think it was 11th, wasn't it, on some fresh softs, you know, got himself right up there into I think fifth position, and then obviously was defending from that point onwards. So that was good. But also, you know, every track we go to, are softs and mediums going to be an option for 100 kilometers? You know, that's very, very track and tire dependent. And that's something which I hope Pirelli kind of factor in when they're making their compound choices. But if we're in a situation where it's clearly going to be the medium tire, let's say, for the 100 kilometers, and everyone's on it, then you might actually end up with, you know, a fairly dull 100 kilometers that just gives the teams more data for the main event on Sunday.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because in recent years in particular, especially with the midfield being relatively close, but then having one, sometimes two, very occasionally three teams sort of a little bit ahead of that, the Q2 tyre rule has, you know, been criticised as sort of disadvantaging the midfield drivers in particular, because the ones behind them, depending on the circuit, of course, and tyre usage, can start on a more natural race tyre, let's say, when the soft might be no good over a course of a race distance. I felt like, and moving to the Sunday race here, much as is kind of similar to the sprint qualifying session, that we really lacked diversity in the tyre selection at the start of the Grand Prix, didn't we? Everyone except Sergio Perez, who we'll touch on in just a second, started on the medium tyre. As you said, the one stop was the default because you had to manage blistering, which meant pace management was coming into this anyway. If this is the way we go, and I know sprint qualifying is not meant to be for every round anyway in an ideal situation, but clearly there are going to be some format changes and the Q2 rule has been mooted to be removed for a little while. Do we need a way to prompt teams and drivers to think a little more creatively? Because, I mean, the longer racing goes for in general, the longer we're at the same tracks, the longer the tyres are more or less the same, the more strategists naturally converge to what is objectively a quickest option.
Yeah, that's right. So, I mean, you can't really win in this situation, because yes, the you know, the rules we have about using your Q2 tyres to start means that sometimes the guys outside the top 10 have a slight advantage, but also when the pace of the front running cars is enough to make it through Q2 on the mediums, then it's inevitably just the bottom half of the top 10 that are disadvantaged. And then it kind of seems a bit unfair, because those guys often, if you make a Q3 appearance and you're kind of in that, you know, 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th kind of bubble, you've actually done a really good job to get there often. You know, if you're in a, say, George Russell situation, or, you know, even Sebastian Vettel and Aston Martin, cars you don't always expect to see in Q3, all of a sudden are at a disadvantage. So I much prefer a free tyre choice. Yes, that it's true that there will be an element of kind of, you know, all the engineers going towards one strategy, but you know, we've seen in, say, France, you know, a perfect example of a great strategy race. You know, the race between Mercedes and Red Bull, they basically had the same options available to them. So I don't think just because they're all going for the same starting tyre, it might take away some of the drama as the tyre covers come off and we find out what the drivers are on. But at least we won't know until that moment for the top 10, whereas now we know. And yeah, I think you can still have good racing as long as the tyres are kind of, you know, degrading at the right level. You can still have really good strategy races, regardless of whether the drivers are on the same starting tyre or not, because it's when, you know, the second pit stops come in as a potential option and the overtaking is possible that a driver can make a stop and then fight back. You know, that's when we get the excitement of tyre strategy coming in. And I don't think by giving all teams a free choice at the start, you will lose that, to be honest.
Now, to wrap up the battle for the lead, because it seems, I mean, you might think with Lewis Hamilton winning because Verstappen's crashed out, there wasn't a battle for the lead. But of course, Charles Leclerc led almost every lap of this race, almost the quiet achiever of this Grand Prix, weirdly, despite having that record to his name. He was ultimately overcome by a much faster Lewis Hamilton towards the end of the race on that hard tyre. But there was this moment, really the first half of the race on mediums, the first stint, where it seemed like the Ferrari might have had the pace to win this one on merit, which is an incredible turnaround given the demands of this track are similar to that of the French Grand Prix, where Ferrari were terrible, like really 2020 spec awful there. So a massive turnaround for them. I want to look at this from two different angles. One, this is obviously a big step forward for Ferrari, which is really credit to work they've done in the last month, I suppose it's been, since that French Grand Prix. But second, that the crossover point for Lewis Hamilton really was everything to winning this race, because he was carrying that 10-second penalty, needed to make sure he didn't drop into traffic or anything like that. And it struck me that it was really dependent on Hamilton to know exactly when those tyres were going to be finished, and he radioed the team as much to define where that stint was going to be. Was this really just a battle decided between those two drivers? You know, we're talking about how this was a potentially a great race between two drivers being Hamilton and Verstappen. Did we miss a little bit that there were two drivers deciding how this battle was unfolding as well at the front?
It was thrilling, wasn't it? I thought it was great to watch. Of course, Lewis had the 10-second penalty as well, which helped even it out a bit. You know, it's fair to say that the Mercedes probably is 10 seconds plus faster over race distance than the Ferrari right now, but mm-hmm. Charles did a great job, and like you say, in that first stint, I think Lewis struggled, and I think part of that was he pushed very hard early on those mediums, opened up a bit of the blistering, and then Mercedes got a bit concerned about it, and they kind of got more comfortable when they moved on to a hard. Another theory that I heard going around, I didn't get a chance to put this to Ferrari, unfortunately, but was perhaps that Leclerc started the race slightly underfueled for the distance, and that would have, of course, given him a bit of an advantage at the start, having a slightly lighter car, and we saw him get past Valtteri, but then also meant that it looked like he was doing quite a bit of lifting and coasting towards the end, and was really having to manage fuel, and that could well be the case, because if you think if Leclerc's race had run fairly normally, you know, realistically, I think Ferrari would have been happy with fourth place, assuming that Hamilton, Verstappen and Bottas all finished the race. So anything he could gain at the start would have been great. So, you know, a lighter car at the start, you know, would help put him into a strong position and away from the likes of Norris. And then, you know, if he can then manage that over the course of the race, then he would have been, you know, in a fairly strong position to get a good result for Ferrari. Now, of course, that all changed when he ended up leading after the accident with Hamilton Verstappen and through the red flag period. And of course, Ferrari had to probably reevaluate their sums on the fuel. But by that point, it's too late. You can't put more fuel in the car. So there is a theory there that that perhaps that contributed to Charles's, you know, dip in performance towards the end of the race on that second stint. But ultimately, you know, I think the performance advantage was there for the Mercedes. It was just a matter of Lewis getting himself onto a set of tyres that weren't blistering and opening up. You know, we've seen that so often at this circuit, especially for the cars, you know, the very fast cars, the likes of the Mercedes and the Red Bulls. They do have to be careful through some of the high speed corners not to damage the tyres. But once he was onto the hards, which you can push, you know, that bit harder and kind of abuse a bit more, it seemed like he was able to access more of the performance of the Mercedes, and that made the difference going into the final few laps. But it still took a fantastic overtaking move. I mean, I'm sure people have opinions on that one, because some people will say that Leclerc was forced off the track, but I think it was a fantastic overtaking move. Lewis going up the inside of Copse, proving that you can overtake at Copse, despite some people's opinions that no one should ever overtake at Copse for for the fear of causing an accident. So yeah, I mean, I thought that was great to see, and I do wonder whether Lewis, he also passed Lando there as well, didn't he? I do wonder whether he did that somewhat on purpose to kind of prove his point that two cars can go through there and emerge on the other side. But it was certainly a brave one with Charles as well.
One element to this final dash for Lewis Hamilton was that he had set the fastest lap at one point, so it was looking to be on track for a very complete race for him, notwithstanding the accident, of course, early on. But that wasn't to be, because Sergio Perez, the only driver not to start on the medium tyre, started on the hards, though didn't really make them last for a one-stop contra strategy, which I thought was interesting in itself, considering he had the opportunity to set up that car for the optimum race in terms of making sure that strategy could work. Putting that to one side, though, stopped late for a soft tyre, took him out of the points. He wasn't scoring a point for fastest lap, but that meant Lewis wasn't. I mean, Sergio Perez knows why he's there. We talk about this occasionally. We talk about the number two drivers, but this was a great ruthless piece of strategizing for Red Bull, despite the fact it seemed like some of them had switched off from the race once Max was out of it.
It's an interesting one, isn't it? I actually think it was exactly what a Formula One team should be doing, because that single point that Perez was on for in 10th, I haven't gone back and looked at it. I think he was pretty much set for 10th, wasn't he, when they pitted him?
I think he'd just taken 10th essentially one lap before they called him in. Yeah.
Who knows? Maybe he would have got another position. I'd have to go back and look at it. But anyway, let's say he was set for 10th position. That point at the end of the championship is going to make zero difference to Sergio Perez, is it? I mean, even if it decides whether he finishes third or fourth, really, who cares? He'll probably be happy not to go to the gala to have to pick up the trophy for third place. So that's going to make very little difference to anyone. Yet that point between, you know, that you took off Lewis could make a huge difference in, you know, going into the final rounds of this year's championship. And for the Mercedes Red Bull battle, is zero sum, isn't it? Because, you know, they give away one point, but they take away one point from Mercedes as well. So in the Constructors' Championship, it's a zero one. So, you know, when you do the maths on it, as ridiculous as it seems, you know, and as kind of like petty as it seems, sending Perez out on a set of softs to snatch away Lewis's perfect result at his home race, it was brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. So, and this is a thing I like about it, because, you know, we had this fastest lap single point thing come in however many years ago it was, a couple of years ago, whatever, and everyone kind of thought, you know, that's what's the point of that, you know, that's it's a bit of a nothing rule and it's only one point. But but you know, the teams increasingly, rather than going the other way and being more conservative with it, are increasingly, you know, strategizing around it. And we've seen a number of occasion drivers pit to get it, because, you know, at the end of the day, that's 23 points over a season if we get 23 races, and that's, you know, that's a lot. If you can chip away along the way and take away single points here and there, it can make a difference. And so I didn't realize this at the time. I actually thought Lewis had got the fastest lap. I had my head down kind of writing up a report and all the rest of it that was going on. But great to see Red Bull pull that one off. I thought that was real kind of F1 stuff, F1 nerdy stuff, but yeah, love it.
It reminded me of, I think it was a 2014 US Grand Prix. Ferrari had Massa qualify ahead of Alonso at the time. And this was, of course, the track was brand new, so one side of the grid was very dirty, and they cracked open Massa's gearbox just to penalize him so that Alonso would move to the clean side of the grid, which was so, I mean, you couldn't say necessarily petty, but so, I don't even know how to describe that kind of behavior, but it was very reminiscent of that. And I thought, you know, on a day that Red Bull's championship leads were absolutely slashed, you know, one point made a huge difference to the margin they had at the end of the British Grand Prix.
Exactly. And you know, that's the thing about F1 is that it's such a complex sport, and the more points and little bits you introduce, the more complicated you make it. But the brains on the pit wall, and, you know, the engineers and the brains within the teams, you know, they're so smart, and they won't miss a single trick. And when they do, they really regret it. So I can imagine that conversation going on the pit wall. And once, you know, I think they would have said, and everyone would have understood exactly the reasons for doing it, and they would have just gone for it. You know, it was a smart decision. May make no difference at the end of the year, but if it does, you know, we can look back and we can say, isn't it funny that decision to pit on, I think it was lap 48 for Sergio Perez, made a difference in the championship. So yeah, interesting stuff.
Cannot wait for one of these one percenters that we get every year, literally every year, to one day actually make the difference, because it's going to be a big moment. And just as a final point, this does come up from time to time, of course it does, because teammates are so important, as we've just discussed with Sergio Perez in this title fight, or potentially will be. Valtteri Bottas had, as much as we say Charles Leclerc might have had a bit of an anonymous race with someone who was leading so much of it, Bottas had an anonymous race. He was essentially undone this weekend by two poor starts in the Grand Prix, both starts, of course, on Sunday, losing a position in each. Couldn't get past Lando Norris. Essentially was gifted the place back because Norris had quite a slow pit stop. He had a problem with a sticking wheel, as did Carlos Sainz, strangely enough. There were a couple of those in the course of this Grand Prix. That condemned him to essentially a slow second stint because the tyres were fading towards the end, but wasn't really quite on the pace. He did, of course, play a role at various points this weekend helping Lewis Hamilton, but of course, at the British Grand Prix, it was inevitable there were going to be headlines about his future, George Russell being the man in line to replace him eventually. Russell had quite an impressive qualifying, had a sort of average race, as I suppose is kind of the norm for a Williams driver in a Williams car. I know it's very convenient to say, well, it's the British Grand Prix, it's the natural talking point for it, but it does feel like every race now is kind of a bit of a test of that the future of that seat. How did you feel about the comparison between Bottas and Russell this weekend? Is it too much to ask a question like that, given that we know it's going to come eventually? And is Bottas doing enough, as much as he's playing that team role, but doing enough to impress that he should be the driver to fill that seat next year?
No, I think it's completely fair to ask that question. And I think it's a question that internally Mercedes are asking themselves. I mean, they're batting them away from journalists, but inside they are asking those questions because they want to make a decision. Toto said that he wants to do it the right way to give whoever misses out the time to secure a seat for next year as well. So I think a decision probably will be made in the summer. I don't know quite when we'll get the announcement, but they're certainly planning to make a decision in the summer, and I think that would be the fair thing for both drivers. And it is an interesting one because, yes, Russell is, I think it's fair to say, the faster driver. I don't think there's anyone who can really argue against that. Maybe Valtteri would argue against it, but I think anyone looking at it objectively would say, look, Russell's your faster driver. But then you look at what Valtteri's willing to do and seems increasingly willing, and I do wonder whether this is him saying, like, look, guys, you know, I am a valuable member of this team. I'm willing to do what's best for the team overall and put that forward as his case, because really right now on a pure pace comparison, that really is the only case for Bottas, is that he is someone willing to play the team game, and I do not believe that George will be as willing. I imagine when he first goes there, you know, and settles in, there will be a period where he'll play along, but you know, he's a very ambitious young man, and rightly so, because he has the talent to go all the way to the top. So I think there will come a time, and mainly because I think George will put himself in positions that are uncomfortable for Lewis and uncomfortable for Mercedes, and that there will be times when it will be very, very difficult for Mercedes to turn around and tell George what to do. So it's an incredibly tough decision, but I think that those are the arguments laid out there, and Mercedes will know what they value the most, and they're going into a new regulation cycle, so there's an element of that as well. You'd figure that would probably be another tick in the Bottas box, because you know, he's a guy who knows the engineering team well, has worked to, you know, get the best out of the cars already. It seems increasingly that the Lewis setups are the ones that Mercedes go with, but there has been occasions in the past where Valtteri's found interesting setup routes that they followed. So you know, he is a valuable member of the team in that way, but you know, if it was me, I'd say it's a no-brainer and it's George, because I think you always want the two fastest drivers, but there are arguments there, you know, slightly nuanced, but arguments nonetheless, that you know, Valtteri is your man, and that over the course of a year, when you look at the best thing for the team, he could be the one that that supplies it. So I think a lot will depend on Valtteri's performances. I mean, he's really only got one more chance to do it, hasn't he, in Hungary? But I say that and think about it as I say it. But yeah, you know, a lot will depend on that. And I feel like Valtteri has got himself out of that hole that he was in a few races ago, especially around Baku, and he's come back a bit stronger. But yeah, it's a really tough decision. But for me, it's Russell, and you know, from what I'm hearing, it sounds like it's more likely to be Russell. But you can see the argument for Bottas.
So many different ways to cut the action from this weekend. A very interesting chapter in this year's championship race. But Lawrence, I can't let you go before I tell you that this episode of the Strategy Report is brought to you by Heel Tread Socks, inspired by iconic cars. You can get 10% off by going to heeltread.com using the code word strategy. But Lawrence, because you've been such a good sport and come on and talked about this race, it was a good race to talk about though, wasn't it? You get a pair for free. You just have to tell me what you've chosen.
Okay, so I actually have the page open in front of me, heeltread.com. And I'm really struggling with this. You know, there were so many easy decisions in this podcast where I made an easy decision. But you know what? I'm going to choose the Red Pig socks, which if you're not aware, that the Red Pig was the original AMG car, Mercedes AMG. And it had quite a funky livery, and that has transferred onto the socks into a very funky design. And I have it here in front of me, and that's it. The Red Pig it is. there were some other contenders that I was very tempted by, but yeah, the Red Pig, why not?
It's an excellent choice. There are a lot to choose from. It is hard to make a decision, but you've just got to commit to that decision. It'll work out, and they'll be on their way to you. You can use the code word strategy at heeltread.com. Get 10% off for your own pair. Lawrence, a real pleasure to talk to you, and I can't wait to see where this championship goes next.
Yeah, me too. Thank you so much, Michael.
Hamilton now trails Verstappen by just 8 points after 10 rounds. But more than the margin, how the pair's relationship will have changed post-crash, the two exchanging subtle barbs in the aftermath, will be fascinating for its effects on the title endgame. This really could be one for the ages. Thanks very much to ESPN F1 editor Lawrence Edmondson for joining me. The Strategy Report is supported by Heel Tread, socks inspired by iconic cars. Go to heeltread.com and use the code word strategy for 10% off. Make sure you never miss an episode of the F1 Strategy Report by subscribing with Google, Apple, Spotify, or your favourite podcast app. And if you like the show, please leave us a rating and a review to help spread the word. You can also find us on social media. The Strategy Report is a Beer Mogul podcast. Special thanks to Ben Loke from Bloke Designs for the show artwork, and our theme music is by Simon Hosford. My name's Michael Laminato, and I'll be back next week to preview the final round before the break, the Hungarian Grand Prix.